Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming out this evening. My name is Greg Smith. I'm the director of the USGS Patuxent Wildlife Research Center, just a short drive around the Beltway. There is no such thing as a short drive around the Beltway. I know you live in Northern Virginia here, most of you, so you should know that already. I actually did work in this building, so I can make those comments, but the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center is located in Laurel, Maryland, and it actually isn't that far. And I'm sure our speaker tonight will invite you, but as the director of Patuxent, I certainly invite you to our center at your convenience. So thank you for coming tonight. I'd like to welcome you. And this lecture series, this evening lecture series here at USGS, is all about sharing with you the work of USGS scientists, the work that is meaningful in your day-to-day lives. And it's about local to global. We cover the entire geographic spectrum. Now tonight our speaker is Dr. Matthew Perry. Matt is an internationally renowned biologist and serves as my senior advisor at Patuxent and has worked for us for more than 40 years. Matt has conducted numerous research projects, mainly on waterfowl nutrition, Chesapeake Bay ecology, and in the management, restoration, and creation of wildlife habitat. His most recent research has dealt with nutritional studies of sea ducks in Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic Flyway, and included work with both captive ducks and dive tanks that I think you're going to see tonight, as well as satellite telemetry studies, a fascinating new technology that we use in wildlife research. Matt has a PhD from the University of Maryland and holds a master's degree from Virginia Polytechnic University. So ladies and gentlemen, Matt Perry and the USGS Patuxent Wildlife Research Center, 75 years of wildlife conservation research. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. Tonight, I'm hoping I can give you a much better understanding of the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center, where I have spent a few years. And I think the first thing you need to realize, it's only been in the last 15 years that we've been with the U.S. Geological Survey. So a lot of the slides I'm going to show are going way back in history, 75 years. Because I want you to see the creation of it. Because it is so unique in the fact that it's not just a building with a bunch of scientists in it. It's a huge parcel of land, and it dealt with a lot of land research in the early years. And so I want to hopefully have you get that concept early on in my talk. So I'm going to talk a lot about the creation of Patuxent, then get into some of our great findings that we've had over the years, and then finish up with some of the work we're doing right now. And I'll be happy to answer any questions when I get through. First of all, I want to go back in time a bit and think of what the country was like when the first Europeans came here. And a lot of the people that were learning about wildlife were people like John James Audubon and other naturalists who were really being paid by Europeans to come over here and find out what we had in this country. And I think one of the things that all the people thought of originally was how much tremendous amount of wildlife we had in this country. In fact, Stuart Udall in his book, The Quiet Crisis, talked about the myth of superabundance and just the fact that we had so much wildlife in this country that nobody was really concerned about. So we went for a long time in the early century of our country having this feeling that there was so much wildlife. And of course, then we went through the period in the late 1800s when we had what was called market hunting. And people were living off the land. And so when you think back of our early ancestors and the culture that we had, it was definitely living off the land. And some of that mentality, of course, still exists in this country, which is a lot different than some of the other cultures in the world. But we closely were associated in the 1800s with market hunting, where people were killing wildlife and then selling them on the market. And of course, there was some sport hunting that caused some problems, especially with the passenger pigeon that became extinct because of market hunting and sport hunting combined. And of course, a lot of our waterfowl populations were greatly affected by these two things. Migratory Bird Treaty Act in 1918 stopped all market hunting, and it also put regulations on what birds could be harvested. And of course, to this day, we at Patuxent are very closely aligned with the Fish and Wildlife Service in setting regulations that allow hunters to kill certain species of birds. So that's some of the early history that we had. When you think of the 1930s, when we were settled, 1936, President Roosevelt signed the land that created Patuxent Research Refuge, an executive order. That's why this year we're celebrating our 75th anniversary. When we first got the land, the only building we had was this Snowden Hall. This is not the old picture. This is only about 20 years old. This picture was taken. It looked a lot more dilapidated back when we first got the land. But that was the major building in Patuxent when the land was first obtained. It's only 2,700 acres, and now we're up to 13,000 acres, and I'll mention a little more about that later. But this was at a time when there was a great conservation movement going on in the whole country, because the country had come out of the Depression, we'd come out of the Dust Bowl era, we had major drainage of a lot of wildlife, wetland areas, and our populations had gone down substantially. So there was a major change going on in the country, which allowed a lot of the things that we were doing at Patuxent to happen because there was tremendous support for it. Patuxent was unique in the fact that it was an old slave plantation when the Snowdens had it, so for many years it had been operated as a slave plantation. And when the Emancipation Proclamation came along, Snowdens had to sell a lot of their land to maintain their lifestyle. And so when the government bought up what is now Patuxent, there were many different parcels of land. So Snowdens at one time owned land all the way from Laurel, Maryland, all the way to Annapolis. And that got broken up over the years, so it was a big change. Anyhow, these slave quarters got destroyed when the government took it over. Now as we enter the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, and talking a lot more about slavery, there's a lot of interest in what the conditions were like back in those times. But unfortunately, we don't have too much information or material from that period. John Snowden was the last person that lived at the Snowden Manor. The Snowden Manor, by the way, was a small home compared to some of the Snowden estates. If you go to Laurel, you're probably aware of this. A couple of big mansions there, Montpelier Mansion, some other mansions that the Snowden family owned. But he was the last resident of the Snowden family on our land. He died in 1928. So from 1928 to 36, the land was in fairly disrepair until the government bought it over, as part of the Resettlement Act, trying to get farmers who were on depleted soil to move out west and to get a new start on life. One of the major people that was involved with getting Patuxent land established as a wildlife area was Ding Dolan. Ding Dolan was the first chief of the Bureau of Biological Survey, or he was chief of the, not the first chief, but he was the chief of the Biological Survey under Roosevelt, President Roosevelt. And he was a cartoonist in Iowa who was very interested in conservation. And he really poked fun at the government, poked fun at a lot of people in his cartoons. And that's what attracted him to Washington. And he was a very enthusiastic person. He wanted us to have a research facility in Laurel, Maryland. He also established the National Wildlife Federation at that time. So you can see in the 1930s there was a lot going on. Well, he actually resigned and went back to Iowa before we were dedicated, but his good friend and his assistant who took over when he left was Ira Gabrielson. And Ira became the chief of the Biological Survey, and then later he became the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service. And he was one of the founders of Patuxent Wildlife Research Center. So we got our land in 1936, and one of the things that was interesting, the reason they wanted this land is because of the Patuxent River and the beautiful floodplain we have. We got flowers down there like May apple, which now you hardly see because of the deer population. When Patuxent was founded, there were no deer whatsoever on our facility. And so deer came in later, they ate a lot of the May apples. But the other thing that was interesting is we had some monster trees, and some of the people thought this was actually a virgin forest. It had never been cut, certain parts of it, because of the river being braided in certain areas. There was no way to get heavy equipment in to cut the big trees. The tree in the middle is a overcup oak, and at the time when I first came to Patuxent, that was the largest tree in the United States of this species. So we've had several other national trees, registered trees, but this one fell down, unfortunately, shortly after I came, so no longer standing. But I think we might still have the largest overcup oak in Maryland. Our first superintendent was Dr. Morley from 1936 to 48. He made his headquarters in the log cabin that's still standing in our facility that was built back in the 1920s. So he was a superintendent. He wasn't considered the director because we had a director of research that was working out of Washington. And so Dr. Morley was really responsible for getting the grounds established, and he was the one responsible for a lot of the buildings that we have today. So we got the land in 1936, but it wasn't until 1939 when we actually got dedicated. And that was a big affair because that was really the beginning of Patuxent. And we had Ira Gabrielson, who you see in the middle right there, that's Ira Gabrielson, and two senators on both sides of him is Senator Pittman and Senator Congressman Robertson. And if you're familiar with the Pittman-Robertson Act, which is an act that gives a lot of money to the states, those are the two people that established that. So they were both at our dedication ceremony, and the person that gave the addresses was the Secretary of Agriculture, because at that time we were within agriculture, and that was Henry Wallace who gave the addition of the speech that day. Ding Dowling was not there, but like I said, it was Ira Gabrielson and Ding Dowling were the people mainly responsible for the formation of the Patuxent. It's interesting to think of a little of the history that was going on at this time. We were part of agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Biological Survey, but then in 1940, we got transferred to the Department of Interior. And so there was a major change that was taking place in the country at that time. Before 1940, when we were within agriculture, a lot of the people in Washington, D.C., but people throughout the country, looked at wildlife as a problem to humans. After this change, when we went from agriculture to interior, people becoming more aware of the problem humans were to wildlife. So it's a major change that took place in our country in 1940. So we left agriculture and all the wildlife research went over to the Department of Interior. And at that time, we were designated as a Fish and Wildlife Service. It wasn't until 1956 when it became a full-blown agency. It was called the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This is an early picture of our road leading into our area, and you can see the Mount Laurel on the left. And over the years, we've had a lot of controversy with our different directors and different administrators in Washington, and I suppose even in Reston, on how the appearance of the facility should look. And so we've gone to people who think it should be just left for wildlife, or other people think it should be well-groomed. During this period, early years, it was definitely well-groomed because they were keeping the mountain laurel free of honeysuckle and other vines, and it was quite an attractive place at that time. These are the three buildings that were first built in 1939 when we got our funds after we got dedicated. This is Miriam Lab, Henshaw Lab, and Nelson Lab. And these three buildings were built between 1939 and 1941 by the Works Progress Administration. So there was a big program going on to get people back to work after the Depression, and they were working at Patuxent, and they created three of our major buildings that were built during that period. But the other thing that was taking place at that time was the fact that we had conscientious objectors to the World War II, after we got started in World War II, and they actually worked at Patuxent. They built Snowden Pond. So this picture was taken in the mid-40s. You can see we had a dirt road at that time going through our facility. But Snowden Pond had just been built by the conscientious objectors. And they were stationed in Snowden Hall and also in Miriam Lab. And they did work progress projects throughout our facility. And then there was also another camp that was over at agriculture that were doing conservation projects because these people were part of the public services program and opposed the fighting in World War II. In 1956, we had our name change, and this becomes an interesting thing, and it's been confusing to a lot of people when they visit Patuxent Research Refuge, because we're also known as Patuxent Wildlife Research Center. And of course, now that we're with USGS, we're USGS, Patuxent Wildlife Research Center. The land area is still Patuxent Research Refuge, and it always has been and always will be. And so now we have two agencies. We have USGS running the research program and Fish and Wildlife Service that runs the land program, the management program. And the reason this is of interest is the fact that the land itself that we do a lot of our research on is protected by Act of Congress. And an interesting thing happened during the Reagan administration when the government was looking at ways they could get rid of some of the what they call surplus government land. And we were asked at Patuxent what land we would give up. And some of the administrators came up with certain parcels of land that we could give up. But fortunately, a congressman came to our rescue and he said, wait a second, this is a refuge. Even though it's called Patuxent Wildlife Research Center, it's a refuge, Patuxent Research Refuge. And we could not give up any land unless Congress voted on it. It was not an act for the executive branch to deal with. It was an act of Congress. So it's an interesting point in our history, 1956. So we still maintain the two names, Patuxent Research Refuge and Patuxent Wildlife Research Center. In the early years, we had a person that worked in Washington from 1924 until he came to Patuxent in 1940. That's Dr. Francis Euler. He was well known internationally and throughout the country for his work on snakes, for his work on food habits, and he was involved with just about everything you can think of. He lived on the research center, and he worked 7 days a week and heavily involved with a lot of projects, and I'll talk a little more about him. I first started working with him when I first came to Patuxent, and I heard some of the interesting stories of actually some of the live snakes that were actually shipped through the mails, and that didn't make the Postal Service too happy when they found out they had live snakes. Fran was also involved with fur research that was going on during World War II. Because of the fact that we had a lot of wildlife at Patuxent, and because that there were servicemen that were fighting in northern areas that we hadn't fought in before, and they were working up in the Arctic and in northern areas of Alaska, they were looking for better insulative properties. We don't think too much of that today. I mean, we like furs, and some people like to wear furs, but we have so much artificial insulation these days that we don't think about it that much. But that was an important program that Patuxent was involved with during World War II. Fran was around 40 years old, so he was one of the few biologists that wasn't drafted to fight the war at that time. A couple of other big names that were involved with Patuxent in the early years was Chan Robbins and also Durwood Allen. They were part of the farm game program that was testing different practices on the land that would be good for wildlife. And you can see them here with two different plants of Chan's touching a coral berry, and Durwood Allen is in the midst of high bush Lespedeza. And so these were two good wildlife plants that they were experimenting with Patuxent. And we were heavily involved with a lot of that as part of the farm game program. And we were actually creating hedgerows and then testing which practices were best. A lot of the plants that you see now that are going exotic and invasive, they are exotic plants because a lot of these were foreign plants we were bringing in. And they became invasive, like autumn olive that you see alongside the roadside in the summertime, and a beautiful smelling plant. Some people have a lot of problems with it. Even multiflora rose and a lot of the other plants came in as beneficial plants at that time that we now sometimes regret that we brought them in. But they're great wildlife plants, except they're not the best for humans, and we'd like to get rid of some of these. They actually had hunting programs at Patuxent, harvested some of the quail there. Nowadays, you can't even find a quail at Patuxent. It's one of the mysteries of what happened. Habitat hasn't changed that much, but quail haven't been seen at Patuxent in many years. And we got involved with call surveys, and people go out as volunteers, just like we do now with the breeding bird survey, and you can listen for quail, but very rare to find quail anymore. One of the things interesting about Patuxent is most of it was forested early on. It was over 90% forested. There were no natural wetlands, and two of the things that they wanted to create at Patuxent were meadows and wetlands. And so one of the first things, there was a lot of tree harvest that was going on. A lot of these trees were cut with some of the unique saws that they had in that day, just coming up with new chainsaws. And then they didn't have the bulldozers like we have nowadays, so they blew up a lot of the stumps with dynamite. And they actually had a dynamite shed where they actually stored the dynamite. Then they plowed up the land, even lined it at that time. They were aware that they had acid wetlands, and so they wanted to line. They lined the fields, and then the lime went into the fields to increase the pH. They had animals, stock animals, mules and horses on the ground that they used for agriculture, and some neat old tractors that they used for harvesting the corn and the wheat, and that was all stored in silos. We had a fur program going on for a long time. This is a tranquilized fox that our mammalogist, Leonard Llewellyn, is inspecting and putting a tag in its ear. There was a lot of projects going on with mammals early on as part of our farm game program and farm management. So we were looking at predators as well as some of the preys. And we had, at that time, we didn't have hot traps. We were actually making our own traps, and there's a handmade trap with a mink inside that they had caught. I mentioned the Patuxent River because it's so unique and still is unique to our facility. And this is the Duval Bridge, which is a historic bridge that goes over the Patuxent River on a narrow part of the river on our property. And Duval Bridge was named for the Duval family. It's a family that goes back to colonial days in that time. And they lived on a parcel of the land just like the Snowdons did at Patuxent in what is now the endangered species area. But the area was very unique because of it being a floodplain, so there was a lot of interest in the plants in that area. But the other thing that was unique about it, it was one of the few, the only waterfowl species at that time that existed at Patuxent was the wood duck. The wood duck was a natural for the Patuxent River, but no other waterfowl existed at Patuxent. So one of the first things that Patuxent got involved with was creating wetlands to attract more waterfowl, because the country was so depleted with waterfowl because of the dust bowl and drainage of a lot of the wetlands. So they started creating wetlands. They made islands in the middle of some areas, hauled clay around for creating the dikes. They excavated certain wetlands, and then other ones they dammed up creeks to make a ravine. Then they made these artificial concrete structures for water level control. Quite unique at the days. We were leading the nation in some of these techniques, and a lot of the states adopted a lot of the techniques that we worked out at Patuxent in the early days. The man on the right is Frank McGilvery, who was one of the early biologists we had in the 60s and 70s. He still works at Patuxent as a volunteer, very active in the waterfowl program we have at Patuxent. This is what a finished impoundment looks like. This is one that created the dike. So the clay was laid down first, and Patuxent River gravel was laid down on top of that, and then the sides were vegetated. But this is what some of the wetlands would look like when they were first created. And of course, once you create these wetlands, then you got to invite the bureaucrats from Washington out. And this is Mr. Gustav Swanson, who was chief of research at that time. And it's interesting that the administrator from Washington is dressed in field clothes, but the director of Patuxent, Arnold Nelson, it was suit and tie because the boss is coming up. But Arnold used to work in Washington. He was the one that was head of research when Dr. Morley was superintendent of the refuge. But then he became our director from 1948 to 1959 and was involved with a lot of our early programs with the creation of wetlands. This is what one of the areas looked like, the Knowles Marsh Complex and Mallard Pond from the air. Then these are the Euler marshes. They were originally called island marshes for obvious reason. And what we were doing is we were studying the design of islands in these marshes. We knew islands were important because of the fact that if you create an island, just like a lot of natural islands that exist in areas like in the prairies of the United States and Canada, birds prefer the islands because there's less predators, fewer predators in those areas. So the fox don't like to go to islands. So typically, ducks and geese will nest on islands. And then we thought, if you created different designs, you might attract more. And so they had this star design, which had four peninsulas compared to the oval ones. It just had two, and that could create more territory, so you had more dense bird populations in those areas. Fran Euler was heavily involved with a lot of introducing a lot of the plants that became part of our area. He was always interested in playing wild celery, but fortunately, I was helping him this day when he put it out and never took it to Patuxent. It's a plant that exists more in freshwater areas of estuarine systems. So Chesapeake Bay has a lot of wild celery, but it's in freshwater areas that might get a touch of salt sometimes a year. But we didn't grow it in Patuxent. But what did grow in Patuxent luxuriantly was wild rice. And wild rice was very common further down in the river. But where we were, up in the wooded areas, we didn't have wild rice naturally. He brought it in. You can see this stand is huge of wild rice, and he was responsible for that. Unfortunately, we lost that rice population, and I'll talk to you more about that later. It was another project we had going on. We were heavily involved with creating wood duck boxes. Originally, we used the Belrose design, which had come out of Illinois from Frank Belrose. And we were trying to keep raccoons out of these boxes. So Clark Webster came up with an interesting idea. He got a pet raccoon, kept it in a cage, and then he uses different techniques to keep the raccoon out of the box. So he actually initially fed the raccoon inside the box, but then he put various predator guards on the boxes, like you see in this situation here, and to see if the raccoon could get in. So these were predator guards. We had great advances since these early days because essentially, if you kept a raccoon out, it was so awkward that there weren't many birds that used it either. So these predator guards, although they looked good at first, they didn't really work out that well. And then we had other guards work a lot better. But Frank McGilvery was also involved with an interesting program of imprinting birds to artificial nest structures. The only birds at that time that were in artificial nest boxes were wood ducks. And what we wanted to do to get other species to use boxes, because if we could get them off the ground and get them elevated, then we could give them better protection from the predators. The raccoon was a major predator at our facility, but there were a lot of other predators like mink and other mammals, and also some avian predators that were causing problems to waterfowl. So if you're trying to build up your population of waterfowl in an area, you've got to be concerned about some of the predation that's going on in that area. And this is one of the boxes, Spock Webster, out in the wetland. And then this is another box on the right where Frank McGilvery is working on. And he wrote a paper on this because this was considered a starling deterrent box. It had a diamond-shaped opening. So the opening was small enough to allow a wood duck to go in and out, would not let a raccoon go in because it was small enough to keep a raccoon out, but it also deterred starlings. And starlings were a major problem, and they still are a problem on wood duck boxes because they take over a box, they'll peck the wood duck eggs, destroy the eggs, and sometimes they'll actually put a nest on top of the eggs of the wood duck. So I mentioned the impoundment management program, but then the other thing that goes along with the impoundment management program was the moist soil management. If we drain the wetlands in the spring, we figured around June 16th was the best time to drain the wetlands after the young ducklings had hatched and were going on their own, feeding in other areas. We could create excellent wetland conditions for the migrating birds in the fall, because we still had a lot of birds. Even though we had a resident population there of waterfowl, we had migrants that were coming in every year. We web tagged some of the early birds. This is a young wood duck that has a little web tag, so we could identify it later and put a band on it. And then we also did some of the early telemetry projects on the center. And some of you that remember the old government pen, you might remember that spring that we had in the government pens. And that spring became a very useful thing in our early transmitters. We actually built these right at Patuxent before the days where we had so many contractors who were actually after our business. This is the last nest box that Fran Mueller put up in the early 1980s, and it was a horizontal box that was built so it could be used by wood ducks, mallards, and black ducks. So it was a big breakthrough to get three species of ducks using an elevated nest box like this. The first Canada goose came to Patuxent in 1948. They came from Blackwater. We brought them in, clipped their wings, and then the problems all evolved from that, as a lot of you know, live over here in Virginia, different parts of the country. At that time, there was a lot of pressure from hunting groups to increase the population of Canada geese. We knew what we were doing at the time, but we didn't know the long-term ramifications, because as the suburbanization took place in the area, more golf courses and other things like this, we started having more problems with what we call our resident geese, and it's still a problem in the East. Tremendous populations of resident geese. And you know, just recently we had a plane hit a bird. We had the planes in New York that have hit birds. So it's a big problem for our aircraft. It's a problem for golfers at golf courses and a problem in some of the suburban areas. And so the resident geese have not been as popular as they were originally, but we had a lot of research that was done on it. So a good part of our history was tied up with making neck collars for these birds. And then we could monitor that movements and all. We got some interesting papers out on this. Although one of the interesting things is when Dr. Stickle became director, and I'll talk more about her in a little while, she found out that people were identifying our birds because they had neck collars on them. And so it was pretty easy for somebody to call up at the golf course and say, come get your birds, because they had neck collars on them. So she asked us to stop putting neck collars on the birds. Here's a goose on a nest, just getting ready to hatch, and here's the female is calling the young into the water. And one of the things we did with the geese is, if we knew exactly when they were going to hatch, we could put a wire around the nest. The female would fly in, incubate, but then in the morning we could go there and catch all the young goslings and put a web tag on them. Then when we caught them in the future, we'd know exactly what nest they came from, and we could put a band on them. That was called a web tag. This is what a typical brood looks like. You're all familiar with this. Goslings following the gander and the goose. The gander having the longer neck, it's a bigger bird, usually closer to the danger, so you can easily see that the male is closer to the danger, and usually the female is taking the brood away. One of the things we had at Patuxent, you probably see it around in all suburban areas, is you have what's called a gang brood. It doesn't occur too often in the wild, but it does occur in a population where you have a resident group and birds are very close to each other. Ducklings seldom get mixed up into different broods, but Geese, for some reason, do get mixed up. If there's a loud noise, backfire from a car or something, all the geese or the goslings will scatter and go to the closest goose. And so sometimes you can have a whole brood go to the wrong parents. And the right parents walk away, and they don't even know what happened. They lost their goslings, and so you get this huge gang brood built up, and sometimes there's been as many as 40 in the brood. And not a very successful situation when it happens. We've had our goose roundups where we catch them and band them every year. We're still doing some of that at Patuxent with a lot of our volunteers. When our impoundments got too much vegetation, like this picture shows with water lily and water shield, if you have too dense of vegetation, it's not good for the wildlife. So we'd have what's called a drawdown. This is an impoundment drawdown, and we worked out the schedule that now is used on refuges throughout North America and also on a lot of the state areas. It's a bigger program that we're involved in. Once the water's being drawn down, a lot of the shorebirds and wading birds benefit by the wildlife, by the fish and invertebrates that are exposed. But then, in the summertime, we have this tremendous growth of plants. This is the umbrella sedge, Cyperus, that grows in great abundance, and we also get smartweeds that grow in great abundance. And then when we flood it in the fall, it's attractive to a lot of waterfowl that are migrating into our area, and they have a tremendous amount of food. We did a lot of botanical studies, and Dr. Neil Hotchkiss was our botanist for many years, wrote many papers on the plants of Patuxent, but then also plants throughout North America. We had a huge herbarium at one time that we recently transferred to the Smithsonian, and we've just recently sent some to the herbarium in Delaware. So we've been trying to cut back on some of our collections because we don't do as much botanical work as we did in the old days. This is a picture of Fran Euler on the left. We did a big study on snapping turtles because a lot of people were concerned that snapping turtles were eating too many of the ducks and the goslings, but the study showed that they were pretty small amount of predation that was going on by snapping turtles. We had a lot more going on by the black snake in the middle, which is over eggs, and then Bill Stickle on the right did a big study on black snakes at Patuxent. We had a good number of them. In the 1960s, Bill Stickle was involved with a power line. Pepco came to us and they wanted to put a power line through our land. There was a lot of resistance to it because typically power companies use aerial spraying to maintain their vegetation. We were opposed to that, and Bill Stickle led the campaign to convince Pepco that if they were going to put their power line on our property, they had to use a different management technique. And so they came up with a program that was called selective basal spraying. Instead of spraying and aerial spraying, which we thought would be a problem to a lot of our captive birds, if you get aerial drift, the power company had to go in and spray individual trees that would grow up to be a problem to the power lines, causing arcing, which we sometimes have a problem if the trees get too high. So every 5 years, the power company hires contractors to come in, and they only kill the trees that would grow up to be tall, the poplars and the maples and the other ones, but they leave all the brush and the small trees like the hollies and the dogwoods and all the berries that are very beneficial to wildlife. So that was a big program that we had, and we're still maintaining that program at Patuxent. One of our other big programs was a bird problem program that we had, and we dealt with problem birds like blackbirds and grackles that caused problems throughout the country. This was with our program for a long time. During the Reagan administration, it was transferred to agriculture, which caused it where it come from originally because agriculture, back in the old biological survey days, was involved with a lot of problem wildlife species. So during the Reagan administration, they thought it would be good to put it back into agriculture, and they can deal more directly with the agricultural problem. So you have a lot of blackbirds that were killed in huge numbers, thousands at a time, that were causing problems in agricultural areas. But that program, was a very big program at Patuxent, and people like Brooke Meanley and other people were heavily involved with banding birds and capturing birds in a decoy trap that's on the right there. That whole program went to agriculture back in the early 1980s. This is the first beaver lodge we had at Patuxent. I mentioned there were no deer at Patuxent when the area was settled. There was also no beaver. It's hard to imagine now we have so many deer and beaver in the area that there were none when the area was first created. This lodge was found in 1974, and I remember the day well because it was pretty exciting. Everybody said, we have beaver, and nobody ever thought we'd have it. Then later on, we learned about some of the problems. Hope there's no safety people in the audience here. That's not the safest thing these two guys are doing, but they're trying to get rid of the vegetation that the beaver have clogged up at the dam here to get the water flowing again. We had a lot of fish created on our area, and we've stocked other areas with our fish populations, but then we also had a fishing program open to the public, and we had some huge largemouth bass there. We were heavily involved with Chesapeake Bay work on the early 40s and 50s, and then the picture on the left is Bob Stewart, who did a huge study in Chesapeake Bay. This is Bob Stewart Sr. Some of you might know Bob Stewart Jr., who's been with U.S. Geological Survey for many years. But this is his father, who was heavily involved with waterfall studies in Chesapeake Bay as a Patuxent scientist before he finally transferred up to Northern Prairie. And Francis Euler was the person that was doing a lot of food habits work tied in with the food availability studies that Bob Stewart was working on. So both these people worked very closely together in the 50s and the 60s. And then in the 1970s, Fran was heavily involved with a big study we did on food habits of canvasbacks. And at that time, Roger C.B. Morton was director of Secretary of the Interior. We always kidded whether his middle name, middle initial CB, was for Chesapeake Bay, or maybe it stood for canvasback. It was a big joke that we had at the time. But he was very interested in canvasbacks, and he gave us a big glob of money. At that time, it was $200,000, and we thought we were walking on air with that kind of money. That was big bucks at that time. So we did a big study with canvasbacks back in the 70s, and it's always been a species, because it's so significant in Chesapeake Bay, it's a species that we've been involved with quite a bit over the years. We used to have a disease program at Patuxent, and that was eventually transferred to Madison, Wisconsin, where the health lab is now. But at that time, we were actually raising sheep to get blood from them as part of the agas and the other cultures that they were creating in Patuxent, making their own cultures. 1959 to 1963, Dr. Buckley was our director at Patuxent, who's on the left. He's talking here with a man named Herb Dohm, who was head of Dow Chemical Company. We were heavily involved with studies on chemicals early on. In the 1940s, the work started by the Stickles, go back to World War II era when we were working with DDT, but it went on for many years and started increasing a lot in the late 50s and the 60s. And we had a lot of pesticide studies going on. We never had the attitude that all chemicals were bad. We were looking at which chemicals were bad for wildlife and trying to be objective in our studies. And so it was interesting when I first came to Patuxent that we had people from the industry who were coming to Patuxent. I remember one day when a whole bunch of executives from DuPont came down and we had a photo op with them with some of our eagles and all. They gave us $50,000. I thought that was pretty measly for the fact that they were so many executives they had sent down in three-piece suits and limousines, and I thought we should have gotten a little more money. But that was an association that we had at that time with some of the chemical companies. And of course, a lot of that changed in the late 60s and the 70s, and also actually in the early 60s, when we got more involved with some of the problems that we were creating from pesticides. We had what we call the worm plots that were established on our facilities, and the worm plots were treated with three chemicals, DDT, Dieldrin, and Heptachlor. They were only treated once, but every year, scientists went out there and dug up earthworms and had them analyzed. 20 years later, earthworms in those plots still had residues of those chemicals that were put down on the land 20 years earlier. And so that was a major finding to show the persistency of those organochlorine pesticides like DDT, Dieldrin, and Heptachlor. In 1972, they were banned from use in the United States. So a lot of the research that we were doing at that time was very influential in banning those chemicals, and the worm plots were a major study that was going on at that time. Of course, a lot of people recognize Rachel Carson as a major person in regard to pesticides. She wrote the book Silent Spring in 1962. At that time, she did not understand why wildlife populations were declining. And we didn't understand at that time. We had been studying pesticides since the 1940s. But it wasn't until 1969 that we published the first paper that showed what eggshell thinning was doing to our populations. So DDT in the food chain was being converted to DDE in the birds and causing problems with the birds putting calcium on their eggs. And so we were ending up with this phenomenon called eggshell thinning. And it was a major issue. Some eggs were being laid without any eggshell whatsoever. So it wasn't so much that DDT was killing birds outright, but it was affecting their reproduction. And that was a major study that our scientists found at Patuxent. And the two people leading that study were Lucille and Bill Stickle, and they were major players. They worked at Patuxent for over 80 years until they retired. Interesting story about Lucille Stickle, because during World War II, Bill was drafted. They both came to Patuxent with their master's degree. Bill was drafted for World War II to go to fight the war, like most of the other men in Patuxent were drafted. Lucille took the opportunity to go back to college and get her PhD. She came back, they both came back after the war, worked closely together. She moved up in the administrative circles and became director of Patuxent for many years, and was also one of the most highly decorated people in the department, highly decorated females that we've ever had in the Department of Interior. Very interesting history on her whole life. At that time, we started out with bald eagles. We were hoping to do some contaminant work with eagles, but we were having trouble getting them to breed initially. So the program eventually turned out to be more of an endangered species program, and we worked more on just releasing the eagles to the wild. So a lot of the states who are having low eagle problems benefited from our establishing their population with eagles. In 1963 and 72, our director was Dr. Eugene Dussman, and he was heavily involved with a lot of contaminant work. Lucille Stickle was his assistant. She was in charge of all the contaminant work. But then we started working with species that we could breed in much greater numbers. We were working with the screech owl and also the kestrel, the American kestrel, because we could raise these birds in large numbers and we could use them on some of our sublethal programs that we had at Patuxent. So we could see what effect sublethal chemicals had on the birds' ability to lay eggs. And a lot of those studies proceeded for many years. We also did studies with black ducks. This is Jerry Longbaugh, who was the first person I worked with when I came to Patuxent, working with DDE studies on black ducks, and those were the species that was used in the first report in 1969. And so you can see, by raising these birds with sublethal diets, you can see what effect that had on reproduction. We also did a lot of work with smaller pens, what we call the meter square pens, and back in the 80s we were involved with agricultural drain water problems, and some of our first studies were being done with arsenic, boron, and selenium. Those weren't problems so much in the east, but they were major problems in California and some of the drain water areas. But we did a lot of work at Patuxent at that time. One of our scientists, Dr. Chris Grew, had an interesting study going on with starlings in boxes, and starlings take these wooden boxes very fast. But he put a camera in there, and he could record the food that the birds were bringing back to the boxes all the time. We did a lot of work with methylmercury, and one of our scientists, Dr. Gary Heinz, is a leading expert in the country on methylmercury, which is a natural natural element that comes in certain flooded areas. And so that can build up in certain amounts. We did studies where we would actually take a large number of eggs, we could drill a hole in them, then put a chemical in them, seal them up with a wax, and then incubate them to see what level of chemicals, what level of mercury would affect their reproduction, their ability of the embryo to live in that egg. And these studies were very influential in EPA establishing guidelines on what how much mercury is bad in the environment. So a lot of that early studies that we did, and still continue some of the studies with methylmercury, are very important from a national perspective. A lot of our work was done with birds that were feeding high in the food chain, like the eagles and the ospreys and the night herons, and also the terns, because a lot of these birds were feeding on fish. And so through bioaccumulation, they were starting to show the effects of the contaminants that were in the environment. We started our program with endangered species in 1965 with our first whooping crane. It was called Canis because of the fact it was named for Canada and the United States, the two countries that work so closely with the whooping crane. Dr. Ray Erickson was the person that established the program. But at that time, because we were getting an endangered species program, we started attracting people of high importance, and we had a visit from Prince Charles, and this is David Eisenhower, and Dr. Lucille Stickle had to go out of her lab and out of her office that day to show them around. And Dr. Stickle was sort of shy. She didn't like these PR days so much like this, and I'm sure she wasn't too excited when she was being interviewed by Helen Thomas that day. This is what our endangered species whooping crane area, a small part of it, looks like from the air. This is some of the area where we have covered pens where we raise whooping cranes. This is no longer existing in that area, but that was the area where we had Andean condors back in the old days. We've had some disease problems with cranes over the years, and sometimes we have to give them a force feeding or gavage feeding. It's one of our vets. We had a very small vet hospital originally, and we had a new one built in 1994, courtesy of Baltimore Gas and Electric. That was a nice new facility that we have. And this graph shows you some of the issues that we were dealing with propagating whooping cranes for the wild. Now, the original population went from wood buffalo breeding way up in northern Alberta down to Aransas, Texas. So, tremendous long migration. We established a shorter one by putting eggs underneath sandhill cranes. Well, the eggs hatched, the birds lived, but they didn't reproduce. It was a big issue because the birds didn't realize that they were whooping cranes. They got a little confused because they were being raised by gray birds. So we started what's called a costum rearing program. And the costum rearing program has been a lot more successful because the caretakers are always dressed in white costumes and they never talk. The only sounds the birds hear are sounds of their own species that's recorded that they can hear. And so the birds are raised in costum rearing, and it's been successful in propagation now in Florida and Wisconsin. And now this past year, we've just recently released birds into Louisiana and getting a new population established down there where these birds have been costum reared. But now we're even going back farther. Because it is still a very slow process and takes a lot of time, we're trying to do more with rearing of the, letting the adult cranes rear their own birds. In the past, we didn't want to do that. In fact, we were originally doing all artificial insemination, and we did natural insemination, but then we were still taking the eggs from the birds and hatching them in artificially or under sandhill cranes. The issue, of course, is birds should be raised by their own species. It gets a little confusing when they're being hatched out by a chicken or a sandhill crane. And so we're going back to the more natural way that we've done in the past. We've done some work with a program called Operation Migration, where we actually train birds to fly behind ultralights, and this is one of the ways we've established migrations. This is some of the sandhill cranes being flown behind a truck. After we get them established, flying behind a truck, and they fly behind an ultralight, and now it's been a very successful program for several years, but we've been migrating birds to new areas. I mentioned the condor program. We never had California condors in Patuxent, but we worked with the Andean condor, and then we were involved with releasing Andean condors back into South America. They're from South America originally. We raised so many at Patuxent, we were able to put some back into South America in areas where they were low in numbers. Our California program, California condor program, was all done in California, and we ran that program for a long time and eventually turned it over to the San Diego Wild Animal Park and the Los Angeles Zoo, and then they were successful in eventually releasing some of the birds that they took into captivity back into the wild. Now, it was a big controversy that we were involved with because a lot of people did not want to take California condors out of the wild, but because of the problems we were dealing with lead poisoning and other issues, we made the decision to bring them all into captivity, and it turned out that it was probably the right thing to do because we didn't lose the species, even though we lost them from the wild. We eventually got them back into the wild, and now that we have a growing population of California condors in California. Just mention something about our migratory bird program. I mentioned Gabrielson early on. Well, eventually we dedicated a lab to him in 1969. This is the dedicating tent out in front. We were heavily involved with a lot of studies, like the September dove hunt, which was very controversial. People did not want to be shooting dove in September when they were possibly nesting. We did extensive studies at Patuxent. We found every nest at Patuxent where dove were nesting, and dove nest in a lot of crazy areas like buildings. This one is a 50-foot nest way up in a tree. We used a telescopic post with a mirror on the end of it to see the egg in the nest. That was a lot of our programs with the dove program. We've also done a lot of waterfowl surveys in the Bay, working very closely, and we're still doing with USGS biologists, working closely with Fish and Wildlife Service biologists. We're heavily involved in NASA brain studies, built some unique pens at Patuxent where we raised ducks in different conditions, and we're heavily involved with black ducks because that was a species that was impacted a lot. This is a scientist in the ditch here. This is the maintenance person on the ground, but Mike Haramus was responsible for design and building all these facilities that were used for acid rain studies. This shows the range of black ducks and why a lot of people thought it was a major problem for the black duck population. A lot of you probably know Dr. Chandler Robbins. He was heavily involved at Patuxent since 1946 when we celebrated our 65th and about 65th anniversary. He'd been there for 60 years. He started the Breeding Bird Survey, the Maryland Bird Atlas, a lot of forest fragmentation work, and also the big Latin American program with migrants. He still comes in every day. He's 92 years old, volunteers every day at the research center. He said, so he sets a standard for all of us to try to achieve. I don't think I'll try to do it, though. We've got a lot of raptor research that was involved in the migratory bird program, but also in the contaminant program. We've worked heavily in Chesapeake Bay. I mentioned Roger C.B. Morton, who was involved with the big money that we got for studying canvasbacks in Chesapeake Bay. Also, here's some work that we did out in the bay with nutria. Nutria has been a big problem, especially at Blackwater, where they've come in and destroyed the marshes. Mike Haramis has been working on this nutria problem for a long time. And recently, he's put GPS transmitters inside the nutria. And so the nutria, wherever they move, are being tracked on an exact GPS location. The problem is you have to capture the animal to get all the data because it doesn't transmit out. It's an internal transmitter. But this is some of the data from one of the animals that Mike had instrumented, and you can see the movements. And the other interesting thing in this project, because the state has a program to eradicate nutria from Maryland as an exotic species, not just to reduce the population, but eradicate it, they want to find every last nutria in the state of Maryland and Chesapeake Bay, and especially at Blackwater. And to do this, one of the things they're doing is to use a transmitter to know exactly where some of these, when you release the animals, you know where the animals will go because you can track them, find out where they are, and these are considered sort of Judas nutria because they lead the researchers to the areas where the population is. They're communal animals, and so they're what's considered a Judas animal, taking the researchers and the trackers to the areas where the animals are. Jim Nichols is one of our research scientists, and Rob Heinz was his assistant for many years, working on a study that was related to birds and forest fragmentation. But to do this study, it was a modeling study, they used a meadow vole, Microtus rodent, and also in a meadow environment. So it was a very unique modeling study where they were looking at birds in a forest, but they were studying mice in a field. And it's a beautiful study that was done with tremendous replication, many years. And one of the interesting thing about it is they put ear tags in all the Microtus, so they knew every individual animal. They knew what their population was exactly through a trap and retrap situation. And then they could fragment the population by going in and plowing the middle of the area. They could separate it into two areas and see what fragmentation did on that population. And then years later, they worked with corridors where they actually put turf back in there and they connected fragmented habitats. So a lot of interesting studies that came out of this early work that Nichols did. We were heavily involved in lead shot, steel shot studies early on. This was a study we did in the Patuxent River Marsh where we actually went in and shot birds, rails, and then with 1 year with steel, and the next year with lead, and we proved that it was the shot that was shot that year being picked up by the birds. And the industry at that time, who did not want to give up on lead shot for hunting shot, they were saying, oh, the lead is going to be out there a long time, so there's no need to stop it because there's already tons of it out there. But this study showed that the birds that were getting lead were picking it up that season, the shot that was being shot that year. And we've done a lot of other lead studies. This is some swans that were killed by lead poisoning that was in sediments. And then we've used the wing survey that's done at Patuxent to actually take some of those samples of the wings and analyze them for contaminants like heavy metals and some of the pesticides. So it becomes a very nice study design to use that. Mr. Harold O'Connor was our director from 87 to 95. We went through a changing period at that time where we were getting heavily involved in environmental education. And there was a lot of push to create a visitor center, and that was one of his main drives when he was working. But the other thing that happened at that time when he was our director is the Disabilities Act was passed for the United States. We built this huge fishing pier that was totally accessible for persons with disabilities. And because it was such a major event, we got the person who sponsored the legislation, Congressman Steny Hoyer, to come out. And also at that time, our county executive, Paris Lindeng, who eventually became the governor of Maryland. During Hal's administration, we built the National Wildlife Visitor Center, and this was a major $50 million facility that's on our property. And this was built for research. It was built to tell the story of research. But what happened at that time is we were being consolidated, all research by the Secretary of Interior, Bruce Babbitt, being consolidated into the biological, into the National Biological Survey. And so we were in a period of flux at that time. We had this research visitor center that was being built, but we were getting transferred out into a new agency, and then eventually we were transferred into the U.S. Geological Survey. And so we left the research visitor center, stayed with the Fish and Wildlife Service as it is run today. We have a very close association with the refuge people in the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they do a great job telling the story of research that we have still going on with the USGS and a lot of the stuff we did in the past. We've had people like Jim Fowler to get involved with our visitor center and also our anniversary events that we've had in the past. In the early 90s, we had a major transfer of land from Fort Meade that came to us, 8,100 acres. We built a new contact facility for hunters and also for the public in that area. We took on a major deer program because the hunters, the North Track, 8,000 acres was a major hunting area. We took that on. During the administration of Dr. Cushlin, we were heavily involved with cowbird research. You can see a cowbird egg up there. Mitigation, wetland areas down here, and also a lot of other studies dealing with reptiles and amphibians. Mike Harris was involved with exclosure studies, trying to keep Canada geese out of wild rice marshes. And this is what Canada geese will do. They'll destroy an area like this. And we didn't realize how bad they were destroying it until we put exclosures out where the geese could not get to. And this is the damage that geese were doing in an area. The same thing we see with the exotic mute swan in a lot of areas. General Howell was our director between 2002 and 2007. We started a lot of work with satellite telemetry. Here's Glenn Olson, one of our vets, doing satellite telemetry in the field. We were involved with more mute swan work, and we created some diving duck facilities that I'll talk about. Our president came out and visited us many times during the administration of Judd Howell because he was interested in our area as not only a nice wildlife area, but it's where he jogged and also rode his bicycle. So we had a lot of visitors from the president during that period, and a lot of people in this area didn't realize it, but he was coming out to our facility quite commonly, and it was quite a big event. And this is the director and also the refuge manager on one of his visits where he came out and talked about migratory birds. I want to briefly show some of the work we've done with satellite telemetry. One of the big problems was capturing birds in the wild. We developed some new techniques out in Chesapeake Bay with what we call a net capture gun, where we go at high speed and shoot the gun to capture sea ducks, which are very difficult to capture any other way. So that's one of the techniques that we developed. It took a long time. It's very intense, time-consuming work. But a lot of the locations that we've had from this, the satellite telemetry that we've done in Chesapeake Bay and also up in Nantucket, a lot of this work is providing a tremendous amount of information on the movements of the birds. And you can see the birds going up the coast in the spring and coming back down in the fall. We did this for 5 years in Chesapeake Bay and also up in the Restigouche River in New Brunswick. And then in the late 2007 to 2010, we were working in Nantucket, and we were working with long-tailed ducks, and we were seeing their movements up to the subarctic area where they breed. So we've got a huge amount of data on with satellite telemetry, and we've worked with a lot of different projects. And now we've done a lot of telemetry work in regard to avian influenza. We've got a researcher working in China, where they've instrumented birds in China to see the interaction that wildfowl have with domestic animals, because there's so many domestic animals in China, and we were concerned about avian influenza transfer. But we've also worked in many other countries. And so these are some of the wildlife tracking results of researchers from Patuxent Wildlife Research Center who have helped other researchers instrument birds. We started a captive colony when we had Dr. Alicia Berlin, who's working on her PhD. Here she is in Canada with a Cree Indian, getting out into remote areas where we got some eggs, and also involved with a selenium study with eiders at Patuxent. And then she did a lot of diving work with a captive colony. We created diving pens that were diving pools that were 9 feet deep, and then had the birds trained to go down and feed on different organisms that we put on the bottom in trays. And so here you can see surf scotus that are feeding on mussels that are attached to oyster shells, just like they would be in the wild. And we compared the energetics that was required to feed on mussels, tearing them off oyster shells, to other surf scotus that were feeding in sand on a clam in Chesapeake Bay. And this is a Mulinia. And so when they're feeding on the clam, it's more of a search pattern. You can see they're going through the sand and trying to find it. And we've been trying to figure out different patterns that animals use for feeding because it's such an important part of our program. Dr. Greg Smith, who you met earlier, was our director last year. And since that time, we've been involved with interesting projects with sea level rise with this instrument here on the left that we're using in a lot of areas throughout the world, including Vietnam, who are very concerned about a lot of sea level rise issues that could affect their crops of rice in the Delta. But then we've also been working with researchers in other countries and trying to detect animals that are low in numbers. And some of our researchers who are heavily involved with modeling and understanding detection rates are using cameras and other techniques. And they've just written a book co-authored by one of our researchers on some of the techniques to determine what animals are found in the wild. And the rates that they're out there, their populations. We're continuing our work with the dive tanks under Dr. Smith's administration. Here's some long-tailed ducks that we're using as part of our telemetry study. We're testing transmitters around the birds and looking at their foraging energetics to see what effect the transmitters might have on their ability to feed in a captive situation. And then we've also done extensive food habits work as part of the sea duck project. Here's a gullet and a gizzard, and then we get this analyzed in the lab. We can keep reference collections and see what food is being fed on by the various species. And so far, just in the last decade, we've analyzed over 1,800 ducks that are all been collected by hunters, not for our project, but they were all hunter-killed birds that we got from them. But one of the interesting things that's happening in Chesapeake Bay and a lot of other areas is that the population of oysters has just dropped out of sight. And I'm sure a lot of you are aware that the oyster population in Chesapeake Bay is now 1% of what it was historically. Well, the sea ducks that we're studying feed extensively, not on oysters, but the organisms found within oysters that are on the oyster shells and all. And so this is a major concern that we have from a population point of view with sea ducks, and why we're working with the university on some of the people that are studying oysters in Chesapeake Bay. I'm going to finish up with a couple of studies that we're working on. This one is with the Smithsonian Institute, where we're testing the electrosensitivity of ducks sensing food organisms. All organisms give off an electric charge, and we think the ruddy duck has a very broad bill and has the ability to pick up an electric charge from an organism when it's feeding. And if we determine this, it's going to be a big breakthrough because we've never known this before. But we have ruddy ducks that are trained to go down to the bottom and feed. And we first train them on mealworms. And then we take the mealworms away. And what we've been doing is putting an electrical charge, very, very minor electrical charge, under this board that we put in different places. And we find that the birds go to the area where this minor electrical charge is coming from. And we don't have enough data to prove this yet, but we think we're on the right track. And we're pretty sure that they do have the ability to sense an electric charge. And so if we prove this, it's going to be interesting because we can look at other ducks and see if they're using this to find food organisms. Because one of the things that people are always wondering is, when birds dive 20 feet down in Chesapeake Bay, how do they see what they're feeding on down there? Is it just that they're just remotely, or just randomly searching for food, or do they have other search patterns that they might be using? And I'll end up with this slide of another study that we're doing with hearing. This is underwater hearing that could be closely tied in with alternative energy, because as we build more alternative energy in Chesapeake Bay and other areas like Nantucket Sound, we're putting out tremendous towers. We have to construct these towers, and then the towers are there for a long time. They could be putting out sound in the water that could be impacting birds. And so we're doing what's called underwater hearing studies with SCAWP. And what we're doing, this is tied up with the University of Maryland scientist who's working on her PhD, but she's got these birds trained to feed for a sound. And so initially, she's just using a clicker, like you use for a dog or a little cricket clicker, and she's feeding them on the surface when they do the right thing. They have to poke that white thing to get a food reward. And now what we've got is the fact that now that they've been trained to do that, she's working with just the sound that's going to be underwater, and they'll only feed if they hear that sound. So the sound can be changed in decibels and volume, so they can see what sounds are actually being picked up by the birds. So that's an interesting study that we're doing. And over the years, we feel like we could do a lot more studies like this with our dive tank and with our large sea duck colony, because one of the things that's unique about Patuxent is not only do we have a huge land area, but we also have tremendous pen facilities to do a lot of the research studies in our facilities. And I'll end up with this picture showing some of the studies that we've done 75 years. We're fairly proud of our science that we've done over the years, and we hope to keep doing it for another 75 years. And I want to just mention that the next speaker is April 6th at 7 to 8 p.m. and the treasurers of the USGS Library. And I thank you for your attention, and I appreciate the honor to come over here and talk to you. Thanks a lot.